Welcome to Author Stories, the podcast where we talk to the best writers in the industry and discuss writing and the creative process. Whether you are a writer, a reader, or both, we hope you'll find something here that makes you love books and the writers that create them. You can find archives of all of the great conversations I've had with authors over the years at hankgarner.com. Take some time and browse around there. I'm sure you'll find a new author to love, find inspiration for your own creative life, and find a new story to get lost in. Let's thank some sponsors who make the show possible. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald, is free on Amazon.com. Seeing the future comes at a price. What price would you be willing to pay to save thousands of lives? Mark Taylor knows his actions scream guilty, but he was only trying to stop the horrible terrorist attack. Instead of a thank you, the government labels him an enemy combatant and throws him in the brig with no rights, no trial, and no way to prove his innocence. He learns firsthand that the CIA can do anything they want to him, anything at all. Mark's just a regular guy, a photographer, who finds himself in an extraordinary situation when an antique camera he buys at a dusty Afghanistan bazaar produces photographs of future tragedies, tragedies he's driven to prevent. His frantic warnings about September 11th are ignored, but put him in the government crosshairs when he learns what being labeled an enemy combatant really means. Download this intense and gripping thriller now, free on Amazon. No Good Deed, book one of the Mark Taylor psychological thriller series by M.P. McDonald. As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, book one by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. From Risa Walker, the award-winning author of the best-selling Kronos Files, and debut author Caleb Ansell, comes a chilling story of altered reality and psychological terror. Chase Ray sits perfectly still, his thumbs traveling across the screen of the broken computer tablet, stuck in the nexus between two worlds. Haddon Wood isn't real. It can't be. Another world, another reality, hovers just beyond his reach. He can see it sometimes. He can almost touch it. In that world, things are in balance. The dead stay dead and the creature feature remains safely on the screen. That world isn't a patchwork quilt of every scary book or movie he's seen. In that world, the nightmares generally end when you open your eyes and people don't glitch in and out of existence. Chase is determined to return to that world, although he's a bit worried that the only way out is through the noose that seems to lurk around every corner. He needs allies to get back home. But how do you choose your team when you can't tell who's real? As the Crow Flies, Enter Haddon Wood, Book 1 by Risa Walker and Caleb Ansell. Simon Says, The John Simon Thriller, Book 1 by Brian Thomas Schmidt. Master Detective John Simon is a tough, streetwise 17-year veteran of the Kansas City Police Department with a healthy disdain for the encroachment of modern technology into his workplace. When his partner is kidnapped after a routine stakeout by thugs with seeming ties to connected, wealthy art dealer Benjamin Ashman, he's determined to find the truth. But the only witness is a humanoid android named Lucas George. Reluctantly, he takes Lucas along as he begins to investigate and soon finds himself depending more and more on the very technology he so distrusts. Meanwhile, Simon's precocious teenage daughter begins to teach Lucas how to sound more like a cop using dialogue from famous cop movies, if only he'd used them in the appropriate context. This exciting new mix of near-future science fiction and procedural thriller captures the gritty realism of Michael Connelly's Bosch, the humor and action of Lethal Weapon, and follows the classic science fiction tradition of Isaac Asimov's City of Steel. From the editor of the international best-selling phenomenon The Martian by Andy Weir, and the national best-selling author of tales including official entries in The X-Files, Predator, and the Joe Ledger thrillers, comes the action-packed first entry and an exciting new series. Be sure to pick up Simon Says by Brian Thomas Schmidt and get into the series on the ground floor. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Susan Goldberg on the show. She is the editorial director of National Geographic Partners and editor-in-chief of National Geographic Magazine. Susan is with us today to talk about her brand new project and National Geographic's brand new project called Women, the National Geographic Image Collection. And what I was just telling Susan, what a stunning collection it is. For those of you that follow us on Instagram, saw pictures that we posted about a week ago or so of this massive book. It's such incredible work. Welcome to the show, Susan.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you. Susan, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I always wanted to be a journalist. I don't know my first memory. One that really sticks with me, though, is when I was in eighth grade in a civics class, we had to write a paper on what we wanted to do. And my paper was called Opportunities in Journalism. And I spelled opportunities wrong, beginning a long career of misspellings. But it really stuck with me, and I've never really wanted to do anything else.
At what point did you realize that journalism was going to be your career path?
Well, I really think ever since then, I never studied anything else. You know, I worked on our yearbook in high school. I certainly worked on the college newspaper. I think I spent more time working at the state news at Michigan State University than I did going to classes. And I just never really have looked back.
When was there a certain type of journalism that intrigued you more than others? Were you drawn to a specific corner of journalism?
Well, you know, when I was growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in the 60s, so there were just tons of protests, student protests over the Vietnam War. And I was really taken by how journalists were able to dig up a lot of information that really informed the public and exposed lies being told by the administration and really changed the course of American history and of that war. And I guess I was first drawn to, I guess you'd call it investigative journalism, but I just wanted to do stories that, you know, shined lights on problems and shine lights in dark places. And I've never really stopped wanting to do that.
What brought you to Washington, D.C.?
Oh, I first came here many years ago to work for USA Today, the newspaper. And I've been in and out of Washington ever since then, really.
Gotcha. You were named at one point one of the most influential women in Washington. What were you doing at the time?
Oh, I've been on those lists a couple of times. I don't remember that particular one. I must say, I think those lists are, I take them a little bit with a grain of salt. But, I've had a number of interesting jobs in Washington. For a while, I ran the Washington Bureau of Bloomberg News. I think that might have been when I first went on that list. But I was just named to a list of, sort of one of those most powerful women lists. And that's doing my job here at National Geographic.
What brings you to National Geographic after covering, working for Bloomberg and kind of this global political stage in a lot of ways? What shifts your focus to National Geographic?
Well, really, I've spent most of my career at local newspapers. I ran large newspapers like the Cleveland Plain Dealer and the San Jose Mercury News. So I really come out of a local journalism background. I was at Bloomberg and the phone rang and it was a headhunter saying, are you interested in going to National Geographic? There's a job that might be a good fit for you. And of course, I immediately said yes, because I have always been a fan of National Geographic. I love the global reach. I love the stories that we can tell here about, the environment, about natural history, about the human journey, about scientific innovation. These are the stories that we've told for 130 years at National Geographic, and all of those stories have a real urgency right now.
Well, as a kid who grew up in the 70s and 80s, I remember that growing up before the internet, National Geographic was our window to the world. If you wanted to know about strange lands and interesting people that you have never met or gotten to experience and maybe never would, the only way to do that was through the pages of National Geographic. Could you kind of tell us what National Geographic's mission is and what has kept you guys on this path moving forward for 130 years?
Yeah, so since 1888, we have tried to take people all over the world and, make people into global citizens, satisfy people's curiosity, explain sort of the global village that we all live in. And that global village really is getting smaller and smaller, as I'm sure you've noticed. And what I like about National Geographic is we can do that, whether we're talking to, readers and users of our information who are world travelers or people who, are sitting on their sofa at home. And the way we have done that traditionally is through strong and powerful visual storytelling. And I've always liked it that we show more as much as we tell, or sometimes more than we tell. So showing people those images, drawing people into those stories through our visuals, I think makes us unique in the marketplace and gives a resonance and an emotional connection to our content that other people don't have. And of course, today, that's happening not just through printed materials, but for instance, on platforms like Instagram. We are the largest brand on Instagram. We have more than 125 million followers. And so it's not really a surprise that people would be, drawn to our photography on this platform and then hearing the authentic voices of our photographers talking about the pictures they've taken and what it felt like and smelled like and, sounded like when they were taking those images.
And that's what really brings this this project, into the third dimension, if you will, when you open this book. And it's a massive book. I mean, it is just chock full and really, elegantly done. When you open the book and you flip through, these 450 photos, some of them are iconic. Some of them you immediately recognize. I've seen this photo, all of my life in different places. Some of them were things I'd never seen before, but all in that really unique National Geographic style of candid. And, there's more of a story behind this photo. And then, indeed, for a lot of them in the book, you do give us the story behind the photo. What was the initial motivation or idea that brought this project to fruition in the first place?
Oh, well, I'm glad you asked, because it really was two things. The first is that we're on the cusp of the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote in the United States. So that anniversary happens in 2020. We got the vote in 1920. So there was that as kind of a peg. But in addition, we're in the midst of a global conversation going on around women's empowerment. And that conversation is happening certainly in the United States through Me Too and Time's Up and other conversations, but it's happening all over the world as women demand rights and get increasing rights all over the world.
What can you walk us through what the from the idea that this is something that we want to highlight and do special coverage for this year? How does this book come out of that? And what other, special media coverage are you doing for this momentous anniversary?
Oh, sure. Well, it actually really did start with the book. So, the book led us to thinking, once we decided that we would do a book about the journey of women, we knew that we had a unique resource at National Geographic, and that's our archives. We have more than 64 million digital and print images in our archives. And really the hardest part of this project was narrowing that down to what are the 450 images that we're going to choose out of that 64 million that would really help tell the story of female empowerment and female progress all over the world. So it really did start with a book. But then we really looked at what we could do with a magazine, which could be more timely. And also, you know, we could go all over the world telling reported stories about, you know, the situation for women in, say, Rwanda or in India. We did some work with Georgetown University looking at the best and worst countries in which to be a woman. We looked at the hidden figures, the scientists who'd never gotten acknowledged, you know, who were female. So we're able to do all of those kinds of stories in the magazine. Then, of course, digitally and on our social platforms such as Facebook and Instagram and Twitter, we've had much more content. We have a special special exhibit in the National Geographic Museum here in Washington, D.C., and we also had a television show about women. So, you know, we're very excited about the breadth of content that we've had to commemorate this really unique moment and very relevant moment in terms of the discussion going on about women around the globe.
What are some of the criteria that you might have used to start sorting through, like you said, 64 or 5 million photos? How that has to be an insurmountable or seemingly insurmountable task. Just the sheer number, volume. How do you start whittling that down?
Well, I mean, you know, thank goodness for computer search words, right? So it starts really right there. But I think what we're looking for are images that feel iconic, that can really, you know, tell a larger story. So we divided the book up not just into a chronological timeline, but into chapters around emotions. So our chapters are joy, beauty, love, wisdom, strength, and hope, and then looked for photos that illustrated, you know, those different concepts. So not only do we want to show, say, strength, but we want to show strength of women in photos that are 100 or more years old right up through the present day. So, you know, those kinds of criteria allowed us to start to narrow down that search. Now, in the book, in addition to the photos from out of our archive, I was so honored to interview 24 of, you know, today's amazing powerhouse women, you know, everybody from Oprah Winfrey to Nancy Pelosi to Melinda Gates to Jane Goodall, and talk to them about the state of women generally around the world and what they think needed to change for there to be an equal playing field, but also about their own journeys. You know, they shared with us their triumphs and their challenges. And so it was very moving talking with them as well.
And you are the first female editor in chief of National Geographic. This had to feel especially special to you.
Well, you know, I do think that that's important, and you know, perhaps that's why it struck me and some others that this would be a good project. But I really think that this project just makes sense because of the conversation that's going on around the world. I would like to think that a male editor also would have had this idea just as well, because it is so relevant and current. And we have such great resources at our disposal to be able to tell this story in an indelible way.
You talked about the 24 interviews that you personally did for the extra content of this book, and with Ms. Winfrey and Ms. Pelosi and on and on. What did you learn from doing those interviews, and did your attitudes or your expectations for the book, did those shift or change at all in doing these interviews for the book?
You know, I don't know if my attitudes shifted or changed. What I really liked about the interviews is I thought that they were a great counterpoint to the historic photos, right? They pulled that book right up into the present. And I will tell you that in talking to these 24 amazing women, two themes really emerged very consistently. And these are very diverse group of women, right? They are across the political spectrum. They have different jobs and careers. They're of you know, different races, different religions, but the themes were consistent. And that is, the first, it's kind of sobering. It was how many of these remarkable women confided that they struggled so much with confidence issues. I just, you know, Oprah Winfrey talked about the disease to please, and Melinda Gates talked about, you know, having trouble fitting in, and things like that. So that was sobering, the challenges that these women had overcome in terms of their own confidence. But the very inspiring message I got from all of these women is how confident that they feel that this generation of young women has every opportunity in the world to advocate for themselves, to stand up for themselves, to know their worth, to ask, you know, to ask that, you know, they get paid right, and to follow their dreams in their jobs. So that was very inspiring to me.
These women that you interviewed, you had a list of, I believe it was 11 questions that you asked each of these women. Could you share a couple of those questions with us? And were you surprised at the breadth of answers that you got?
Well, sure. The, you know, the 11 questions ranged from, you know, questions about their own journey. So what is your greatest strength, or what is your breakthrough moment, or tell us about the biggest hurdles that you had to overcome, to questions about the state of women in general, such as, what's the most important challenge facing women today? And what advice would you give to young women? We really tried, and what needed to change in the next 10 years for women to have an equal playing field? So we really wanted that personal story, but as well as their reflections about the state of women in general.
Were you surprised by any of the answers that you got in your interviews?
Oh, I was surprised by a lot of the answers. I mean, you know, when you have one of the breakthrough scientists of the modern age, Jennifer Doudna, tell me that she wasn't sure at one point that she had, you know, that she had the ability to be a high school chemistry teacher. You know, that I was very surprised. You know, when you really hear people talk about things like that, where you've got these amazingly accomplished women and they're talking, you know, very frankly about some of the, you know, things that they had to overcome in their own lives, and doing so in very candid and stark terms. So I was surprised in a good way that they were willing to be that transparent and that vulnerable. But I also, I guess, was surprised by the consistency of how inspiring they were, particularly when talking about younger women and the belief that things are going to be so much better for this next generation of women coming up.
The book is not only singularly focused on women, but it's also entirely put together by women. Can you talk a little bit about that decision to have the book completely done by women, and also the magazine issue? All of the contributors are women.
Yeah, it's really the magazine that was 100% done by women. So in our 131-year history, we've never done this before. So all of our contributors, the writers, the photographers, the illustrators, they were all women. And it was so terrific to know that we have so many wonderful female contributors and really could celebrate them in this moment. The book, the majority of the book, is put together by women. Of course, some of the older pictures, especially in the book, are taken by men because it reflects a time when we really didn't have many female photographers. And I think that's one of the important points, which is when you look at how images of women have changed over 131 years, I think not only have they changed because women are doing different things, but also because of who is taking the pictures. So we've got more and more women taking those pictures, and I think they're capturing, you know, a different view of womanhood.
What is the overarching message of this book? What do you, when people get the book, what do you hope their experience with the book is?
I think ultimately that people will walk away from this inspired by the progress that you see women making, inspired by the strength of the images, by the diversity of what women are doing. I think that's a very powerful message. Now, that said, I think there's a secondary message that is equally important, and that is we've got pictures of women in countries where women are not empowered, where, in fact, they are silenced, where they are terribly oppressed, where they are subject to violence. And I think it's important that we look at those images as well, because only when we shine a light on those stories do we have any chance of, you know, having equality for all women, not just some women.
Like we mentioned earlier, National Geographic has been a staple in so many people's lives. And, I know lots of people that have huge collections of National Geographic magazines that they've collected through the years, and like I said, for people my generation, and I know people before me, National Geographic was our window into the world. With the way the media landscape is changing and the interconnectedness of the world through the internet and various other technologies, how do you see the future of National Geographic? And I know you guys are doing amazing things on social media, like you're talking about with Instagram. What is the future focus of National Geographic as you see it?
Well, I think what's important for us and what is important for all of the so-called legacy media companies is that we're putting out stories that are reaching readers on the platforms in which they want to be reached. So, you know, we're going to take stories and you're going to go report one time and they're going to look a certain way in a printed magazine. They're going to look differently on a digital platform. And depending on whether people are seeing that on nationalgeographic.com or on Snapchat, right, where we've got a very different audience, or on Instagram. So, depending on the platform in which people read those stories, they are going to be different for the audience that we're going to find there. And I think that that's fine, because you can't do the same story on different platforms. It just doesn't make any sense. You've got to take that content and make it work for the different platform. But I think that we're very lucky in that the stories that we have always told are stories that have real urgency right now. I mean, we have been covering the earth and the planet and species preservation and the environment and for 130 years. Well, those stories, you know, which are stories about climate change, for example, and the sustainability of the planet, those are hugely urgent stories right now. So I think the topics we're covering are quite urgent, and the ways we're covering them are quite modern.
Well, the new book is called Women, the National Geographic Image Collection. It's available everywhere now. What a great Christmas gift this would make for anyone in your life. Susan, thank you so much for joining me today on the show to talk about this book. We're going to link up the book in the show notes where people can go purchase theirs. Their copy of it. Is there a place online where people could connect with you and see more about all the great work that you guys are doing if they want to check in the show notes?
Oh, sure. NationalGeographic.com. You can see a lot of the work that we've done both in the book and in the magazine, as well as just some digital-only stories. You can see that at NationalGeographic.com. And then the book, of course, is also available at Amazon.
Excellent. Susan, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Now stay tuned for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Gleaves, the Jason Crane series.
You took a terrible risk tonight.
Why?
You don't know? The first rule.
I was told by a friend that I shouldn't reveal my gift to anyone who doesn't have a gift themselves.
That's exactly right.
Because everyone we tell dies.
Yes. You might have marked me for death.
Made you a target for a ghost. Why can't people know what we can do? What makes it so dangerous? Valerie took up the fireplace prongs and stabbed the logs.
It's called the great curse.
Sparks exploded from glowing crevices and drizzled upwards, ricocheting off the black belly of the cauldron, turning into tiny ashes that disappeared up the chimney.
It was cast by a powerful witch over 300 years ago.
Witch? Sorry, but witch? Please, there's no such thing. Valerie closed her eyes. A spoon leapt from Jason's dish and caught him in the temple. He wiped melted ice cream from his cheek. You were saying?
She cast the curse to stop the witch trials.
In Salem? Jason searched his memory. 1690...
1692. They burned her alive in the Salem Common. The only witch to be burned.
The cauldron smoked slightly. Its contents had evaporated. A sharp, charred scent filled the room. Wait, said Jason. There were no witches. They were just, I don't know, victims of religious hysteria, right? So you're saying the witch trials were justified?
Justified? So if a witch did exist, it would be okay to kill her?
No, I just thought... You're right. Never mind.
There was one witch in Salem, at least. A woman with a powerful gift. She only wanted to protect people like us. To give the gifted their anonymity, refuge. She cast the great curse as she burned. She proclaimed that mortals who know a witch shall know death. And that is the great curse. And it's still in effect after all this time.
Mortal, as in?
Non-gifted. No mortal can know about you, about any authentic witch.
Jason winced. Isn't there another word besides that? She shrugged. So no one can know what I am, what I can do, or else they become a target.
Right. The spirit world will obey the great curse and try to kill them.
The spirit world.
The other realm.
Jason rubbed his eyes. How much of this was reality and how much of this was Valerie's nutty brand of mysticism? He felt himself pulling back, as usual, for fear of contagion. He'd spent his whole life reading science fiction. He hated paranormal tales. This was not his genre.